Welcome to the Global Journalist on KBIA. This program is dedicated to the idea that mid-Missourians, indeed most Americans, are interested in international news. My name is Roger Gafke of the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm substituting in the role of host for my colleague Stuart Laurie. We have two topics on our program today: a look at the aftermath of last month's presidential election in Zimbabwe, and an update on the work of a government commission in Peru that has begun to gather testimony about the 20 years of violence in Peru that is said to have resulted in the deaths of some 30,000 citizens in battles between the Shining Path and other rebel groups and the crackdown by government military forces. The commission is scheduled to turn in a report about what happened and who's responsible in the summer of 2003. In Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe won a sixth-year term. He's the only president that country has had since it gained independence from the British in 1980. Our guests today are Andrew Meldrum. Meldrum is a member of the Executive Committee of the Zimbabwe Foreign Correspondents Association, based in Harare, Zimbabwe. He's a correspondent for The Guardian and The Economist in London. Raymond Lowe. Mr. Lowe is editor and publisher of the Southern Africa Report in Johannesburg, South Africa. Mirko Lauer is a columnist for La Repubblica in Lima, Peru. And Priscilla Hainer, program director for research and technical assistance at the International Center for Transnational Justice. Ms. Hainer is the author of Unspeakable Truths, Confronting State Terror and Atrocity. Let's begin with Andrew Meldrum. The most dramatic events that I have become aware of in the aftermath of that election are the charges of treason against President Mugabe's main opponents in the election. What's the status of those charges now?
Well, the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, and two of his deputies have been formally charged in court with plotting to assassinate Mr. Mugabe. It's a very serious charge of treason, which carries a death sentence. But they've been released on relatively low bail. They are free to move about in Zimbabwe, although their travel documents have been seized, so they can't leave the country. The government is not proceeding with the charges at full speed. It seems to be delaying. To be honest, the case doesn't seem very strong against Mr. Tsvangirai and his other officials. And I think the government really wants to wrong-foot the opposition by pressing the charges against them. But I don't think that they actually want to bring them to trial or to see them behind bars, because they would fear a very angry public reaction against that.
What are the other developments in the aftermath of the election?
Yes, it's been a month or maybe even 6 weeks since the elections, which were held on March 9th through the 11th. And really, following the elections, there has been no let-up in the state-sponsored political violence against the opposition. And, in fact, there has been a wave of violent repression against anybody identified as being members of the opposition, the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change. In particular, there were several thousand people, 12,000 people, who were opposition polling agents who were representing their party at each of the 4,500 polling stations. And those people, their names had to be made public according to electoral laws. And they have been targeted systematically throughout the country. Mr. Mugabe's supporters, war veterans and youth militia and others have gone throughout the rural areas and have rooted out these polling agents. And they have been beaten, their homes have been burnt to the ground, and several of them have been killed. So it has been a very violent follow-up to the election.
Is there anything on the positive side that Mugabe's mandate gives him? Is there any positive agenda at all that comes out of that election?
Well, Mr. Mugabe has not really put forward a positive agenda. The one major action that he has taken since he won re-election was to sign into law a new media bill, which is widely criticized not only in Zimbabwe but internationally as one of the most repressive media laws around. And so that was really the first action that he has taken since his re-election. In other actions, he has not yet announced a new cabinet, and he has not announced any new policies. And what Zimbabweans, in addition to the the political violence the country is survive, you know, trying to endure. There also is inflation of 115%. There is a serious food shortage of the staple food, maize meal or corn meal, and several other basic commodities like cooking oil and sugar are in short supply as well. So you asked for some positive news, and I'd be happy to give it to you, but in fact there's very little here in Zimbabwe at the moment.
Let me shift to Priscilla Hayner and ask you to bring the academic perspective to this Zimbabwe situation from your work. Now, what comments would you have that would help us understand what's there?
Sure. My work has been focused on looking at countries around the world that have turned to transitional justice possibilities, especially truth commissions and other accountability mechanisms, at a time of transition to try to confront and somehow reduce conflict around past crimes, particularly human rights abuses. Now, of course, Zimbabwe has not yet gone through a transition, although everyone is expecting that sometime in the future, perhaps in the near future, there will be a change. Obviously, the situation is very tense now. Now, what kinds of mechanisms Zimbabwe might turn to in order to account for the crimes that are going on now and have gone on over the last years is something that must be decided by Zimbabweans. What's most interesting, if you look around the world, ranging from Sierra Leone to East Timor to Peru to Central America to the southern cone of Latin America, you will see very different kinds of mechanisms being put in place, and that's very appropriate. They must be designed by nationals to respond to national needs and possibilities and opportunities. Something like a truth commission at the heart is, there's something similar in the 20 or so countries that have had truth commissions to date, but each has been different as to what powers that might be given, what kinds of investigations should be taken on, whether there's a link between a non-judicial truth-seeking process and something that might take place in the courts in terms of more formal justice later. All of those things need to be discussed by Zimbabweans when it is the right time to discuss that, and I imagine there will be a day when that is something that must be discussed by Zimbabweans.
Let me move to Raymond Lowe now in South Africa and ask you to make comments about Zimbabwe from a South African perspective. I had noticed one press account after the election that President Mbeki was accepting of the election results, but just recently he had been on a Commonwealth Commission that had recommended suspension of Zimbabwe from that. Where does all that stand?
Well, it leaves us with a feeling of despair. both what's happening in Zimbabwe, and we look upon it from afar with a great deal of horror and apprehension. Andrew, I notice you didn't mention in your discussion of the situation there the latest threat from the war veterans against the 12,000 Asians in Zimbabwe. Mm. Who are going to be, according to the war veterans, dispossessed of their farms and businesses and other commercial properties that they have, which certainly sounds ominous. There was a reference in that shortwave radio station that broadcast from London into Zimbabwe about the key witness in the treason trial, the Tsvangirai treason trial, apparently deciding not to give evidence. I don't know whether there's any truth in it, but I'd welcome your comments on it. But coming back to our views on it, ours are also tinged with the fact that we have this, how can one describe our attitude, our political attitude to the government's political attitude to Zimbabwe, which started off as, quote, quiet diplomacy, unquote, and achieved nothing. And has been pussyfooting around the subject ever since for the last 2 years. We've never really done anything to make Mugabe feel that there is really serious opposition within a fellow Southern Africa democratic development community country, such as South Africa is, against what is happening there. Mbeki, our president, is supposed to have told Mugabe in private conversation that he disapproves of it, of what has been going on, but I don't think that has any resonance either with the people of Zimbabwe or with us in South Africa. and his attitude towards the election is remarkably ambivalent. He accepted the finding of the team that was sent to observe the elections from South Africa, and then found himself in the situation of having to suspend Zimbabwe from the British Commonwealth because of the finding of the Commonwealth Commission, which was right, exactly the opposite of the South African finding.
Yeah, Andrew, do you want to get in with any follow-up comment?
Well, yes. I do think that really the most important finding on those elections was the Commonwealth finding, which found that the elections were neither free nor fair, nor they even said they were illegitimate. They were marked by state-sponsored political violence, by a very partisan police force that acted against the opposition party, and then there was widespread evidence of very serious voting fraud, and that's what the Commonwealth really very bravely and strongly stated. And unfortunately, the South African government's observer mission to Zimbabwe really gave what was rejected by everyone here in Zimbabwe and by many other observers as a completely useless. Well, but they gave what they had intended to do from the very beginning. They gave an endorsement of the elections and an endorsement of Robert Mugabe's victory, and it makes it very unclear what Mr. Mbeki's agenda is regarding Zimbabwe. And I'd like to pick up a couple of other things that Raymond pointed out. Yes, aside from the political violence that I was talking about against the opposition, there also have been quite a bit of violence and threats on the farms. And there's been a stepping up of seizures of white-owned farms. And these are not according to Zimbabwe's law. These are illegal, even according to Zimbabwe's own laws, seizures. And they have been done by an announcement by a war veteran leader, Andrew Ntlovu, and he said that all white farmers must be off their farms by August. And it looks like they are being thrown off at a very rapid pace. And it is this same Mr. Andrew Ntlovu who then issued the threat that Raymond pointed out that happened 2 days ago against Zimbabwe's Asian business community, saying that they must give up some of their shops and of their factories because they too should be owned by black Zimbabweans and not by Asians. And it's a very worrying situation and reminds one a great deal of Idi Amin in Uganda, where the Asian businesses, where the Asians were thrown out of the country. And I think it shows the level of gross insecurity that virtually everyone in Zimbabwe is feeling. And the mistake would be to say it's against whites or it's against Asians. It's also against black Zimbabweans. It's against anybody who really dares to challenge Robert Mugabe's rule or that of ZANU-PF. They have latched on to the whites and the Asians, thinking that those will be popular. But in fact, as I pointed out, there are the black supporters of the MDC throughout the country that are really suffering. And in fact, I spoke to some Amani Trust, which is a human rights monitor here in Zimbabwe, and they have on their record 69,000 Zimbabweans, black Zimbabweans, who are refugees in their own country, who have had to flee their homes because of this violent political retribution. And that's a humanitarian crisis within Zimbabwe of, nearly 70,000 people who are now in hiding across the country. And it's a very serious situation.
You two described what, to my ear, now sounds like a really nightmare situation. I want to bring in our fourth guest here on the Miracle Hour in a moment, after we take a little break here, and get an update, because it could be that Peru, in fact, has moved through its nightmare and is on the other side of that. But right now, let's take a break. This is The Global Journalist on KBIA. Yes, you're listening to The Global Journalist on KBIA. Miracle Hour, a columnist for La Repubblica, in Lima, Peru. Would you bring us up to date on the work of the Reconciliation and Truth Commission there and respond a little to my observation that your country may have moved through that nightmare of terror and all and is on the other side? Can it be that hopeful?
Well, yes. I would start at the end of your question. I would think that the worst is very much over. there is discussion on whether there could be some remains of terrorist organizations, but I think that the political story in relation to dangers to the state is very clearly over, and now we are stuck only with social and economic violence in the country. Now, the Truth Commission in Peru is rather atypical, at least in the Latin American context, since it was set up at the end of 10 years of authoritarianism and part of a dictatorship, but for some strange reason it ended up investigating democratic governments as well. The 1980-1990 period, we had democratic governments. The reason for this has been that it's been 20 years or 15 or 16 years of these 20, we've had anti-terrorist, anti-subversive, anti-guerrilla struggle, and this is when these atrocities that are being investigated were produced. Now, the problem now is that the democratic parties that are under investigation because they were in government when this fight was going on are the same ones that are not participating in the democratic process. So their argument is, gentlemen, why investigate me, who was and still am a Democrat? Why not go into the investigation of President Alberto Fujimori's government that was not democratic, when atrocities were committed across the board? And this has created some problems for the Truth Commission. Nevertheless, they have started working already, and they have concentrated themselves on opening mass graves, yes, which is an important and necessary process. But because of its very religious, very Catholic composition, my personal feeling is that they're more into the healing of the national soul business than into the seeking truth from facts business right now.
Now, as I understand the work of this commission, there is not the provision for absolution from crimes and that sort of thing. In the translations I've read of the work of the commission, the task was to find out what happened, who's responsible, and to lay the foundation for prosecution and reparations and so forth. If that's the case, why would anyone cooperate because of jeopardizing your own safety and situation?
Well, definitely they are not getting much cooperation. And furthermore, there is something a bit limp to this scheme. We must not forget that the first Truth Commission started in countries where the main culprits were the military, which remained strong. So the Argentinian Truth Commission and the Uruguayan Truth Commission, yes, and a bit in Central America as well, I think, are very careful in terms of who they investigate and how long the legal reach really is. In those cases, I understand this was necessary because it was dangerous to go into those fields and very brave of them to do so. But in this new situation in which armies are receding in front of masses that are sort of taking democracy, no, electorally and through the street, I would say that Truth Commission should have more power, but far more specific areas of investigation. In other words, we should have one commission to study what happened in the fight between the Peruvian state and Shining Path or the MRTA guerrillas, and we could have another commission that studies what really happened under the government of ex-president Fujimori. But yes, and in one case, probably you should have prosecuting capacity, yes, as a way of collaborating with our very weak judiciary system. And in the other case, maybe you should have another type of investigation. Since now there have already been about 23 or 25 truth commissions in the world, maybe it's high time they started specializing a bit.
Ms. Haynert, let's pull you into the conversation and invite your comments from your perspective on what you see in Peru.
Sure. I'm fascinated by the comments by Mr. Lauer. I had the good fortune to be able to be in Ayacucho 2 weeks ago when the hearings for the Peruvian Truth Commission opened, which was a fascinating process to watch, and certainly as would be very intimately known by Mirko Lauer, it's the first Latin American Truth Commission to hold public hearings in the course of its work. All other Latin American Truth Commissions have focused on investigations and coming out with a report at the end of a year or 2 years. Having watched South Africa's Truth Commission have a very, very public element to it, and enticing not only victims and other witnesses, but also perpetrators to come forward and speak publicly about what took place, has given other countries a very strong sense that this is a process of bringing the country along rather than just a process of coming out with a report investigating specific facts. I very much agree that it is, as was said, it's a difficult call as to what should be incorporated within the mandate of a truth commission. This one does cover 20 years from 1980 to the year 2000. And I think from the outside, looking into Peru, it actually, I think, will be a surprise to people that the vast numbers of cases coming to the commission, the majority are actually abuses by the armed forces rather than by Shining Path, which were, of course, Shining Path abuses were well known around the world. But in fact, the counterterrorism tactics used, particularly in the mid to late 80s and into the 90s, resulted in fairly extreme acts that have never had a chance to be publicly known or, in a sense, unsilenced, that people could talk publicly about what happened and claim their history, claim the information they need about people who are disappeared and such. So this process is opening up a lot of strong feelings in Peru. There's considerable public support for it from what I experienced and what I've seen reported on and polls taken, but it's certainly not an easy process, and as certainly our Peruvian colleague could speak to and has mentioned briefly, there is a bit of a political backlash already by those persons, a particular political party, that I think has the most to lose in the process, because when they were in power in the 80s, their acts are now being dug up and put into the public spotlight. And I think what we're seeing in Peru is a very clear example of both the power and, in a sense, the risk of coming to terms with what really happened in a country. And thinking back to Zimbabwe, one can only imagine, and I hope there's a time sometime soon, where coming to terms and actually opening up the full truth about what happened could be extremely powerful. It's not sufficient. A judicial process must go hand in hand with that, but it opens up all kinds of strong feelings within the country, which I think is a healthy process.
Mirko Lauer, did I understand you to say that you thought one of the goals or purposes of the Truth Commission was social healing now, rather than fault finding?
Yes, I think it is very important, and they are very much into, when you listen to the declarations of the members, this need to reconcile, yes, reconciliación, which is a very, very Christian type of term in the Spanish tradition. People have to be reconciled, and the idea is that truth will not only make us free, but the truth will make us come to terms with what has happened and with one another. Because contrary to other places, the fact is that the whole drama of the Peruvian bloodshed is sitting across very clear and nasty racial, ethnic, cultural lines, yes? The most of the dead, yes, produced, in effect, as our friend told us, by the military and also by the Shining Path, most of the dead are, in fact, poor peasants from the faraway regions of the country. So all this has also the trappings of abuse, of having somehow managed in this country to produce a civil war that has produced 90% of its victims among the poorest and the most needy of the country. And this is something that also has to be solved, and that has to do with very, very contemporary or very, what you call it, the day-to-day issues in this country. I would say that if you had made it a commission to investigate extreme poverty, for instance, in Peru, you would have arrived at the same place. Now, I would like to make a comment on what was said before here about the Truth Commission unearthing atrocities or deaths or whatever, acts done by the military, I would like to say that they have not really started yet. The first, let's call it dramatic, yes, revelation about something that people did not know about a hidden or a buried truth coming out that would sort of affect sectors in power in Peru has yet to appear.
All right, so that work is... Let me, for a final comment, let me switch back to Raymond Lowe. The truth and reconciliation effort in South Africa surely had that social healing as its central goal. As you've heard this discussion, what reaction or advice do you offer? What commentary would you offer about what you hear now about the Peruvian situation?
Well, that's quite true. There is a healing that takes place in a process like that where people who are the victims are able to come forward. Don't forget that they were oppressed and unable to speak out before when the authoritarian government was in power. They are able to come forward and tell their story and their stories and seek to find out what actually happened and why did it happen to them or to their children or to their husbands and wives. And that certainly has a healing quality about it. But I think the rather distinctive feature between our Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Peruvian and some of the others in South America was the question of being able to apply for amnesty. We had that provision in the Constitution, or at least in the law setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that there wasn't it was possible for people who'd committed atrocities to apply for amnesty.
And do you?
And if they came clean, if they told the truth, they were granted amnesty. And the thought behind that was, you know, there were two thoughts in South Africa. One, do we go for Nuremberg-style trials, which a large number of the liberation movements would have liked to have seen happening, or do you go for a process where you are likely to find out what actually happened by giving the perpetrators the opportunity of coming forward and saying that and then gaining amnesty? If we'd gone the Nuremberg route, well, those people would not have come forward. The perpetrators would certainly not have come forward, and they would have kept silent, knowing full well that they had everything to lose.
Raymond, let me interrupt you. Because we have expired our time, and we're going to have to leave it on that note. I want to thank all of our guests today. Andrew Meldrum, Executive Committee Member of the Zimbabwe Foreign Correspondents Association in Harare. Raymond Lowe, the editor and publisher of the Southern Africa Report in Johannesburg. Mirko Lauer, the columnist for La Repubblica in Lima, Peru. And Priscilla Hainer, the program director for research and technical assistance at the International Center for Transitional Justice in New York. My name is Roger Gafke of the Missouri School of Journalism. Thank you for listening.